My name is Zachary Bakke. I'm the Knowledge Management Specialist for the Bureau for Food Security. Welcome today for the November Ag Sector Council. We're looking to reschedule the October Ag Sector Council. Sorry that we had to cancel it due to Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Sandy or whatever you want to call it. So look for that in the future. I just wanted to kind of briefly go over a few new items to check out on AgriLinks. We've got our latest video note with Dr. Shukri Ahmad speaking about risk insurance. And then we're also having another event kind of concurrent with this one on the Partnership for Innovation. That actually will be recorded and put up on AgriLinks as well, just like this Ag Sector Council. I'd also like to highlight the next upcoming Ag Sector Council. We'll be joined by the Enabling Agriculture Trade Project, talking about their latest fertilizer brief, and that's coming up on December 5th. Also, watch out for probably in that first week of December, we're going to be looking to do a Twitter chat in collaboration with the Development Credit Authority office here at USAID, and so keep an eye out for that. We're looking to do more of those at least once a month. We just did our third one on the Women's Empowerment Agriculture Index, so you can check out some of the highlights of that up on the AgriLinks blog. I'd also like to highlight that part of our evaluations, which you'll see on your chairs or we'll be sending links for those of you online, highlighted the fact that people really wanted to hear more about livestock, wanted to hear more about nutrition, also the linkages between agriculture and nutrition. And so hopefully with this presentation by Montague Dement from APLU, we'll be able to be addressing some of that. So also please hold questions till the end. And with that, I'd like to hand over our introductions to Julie Howard, Chief Scientist for USAID.
Great. Thanks very much, and good morning, everybody. This promises to be a very exciting session, and I don't want to stand for too many minutes between you and your speaker. But Tag is an old friend and colleague, and I did want to say a few words about his work. Tag is the Vice President for International Development at the Association for Public and Land Grant Universities here in Washington. And his work today is going to focus on work he did while he was at UC Davis. He's the former director of the Global Livestock Collaborative Research Support Project. He's a professor emeritus of ecology at Cal Davis. And Tag's going to speak, as you see here, on animal source foods and child cognitive development and how the project passed from being a USAID-funded project to taking on its own sustained life with the private sector. And I guess I wanted to just spend a couple of minutes giving you three points, really, building on the same point about how projects pass on to take on a life of their own. I think Tag is one of those lucky people who in mid-career can look back and see some of the impact that he's having, not only in this particular sector, but on Feed the Future itself and on development policies related to food security worldwide. And what do I mean by that? Well, I know you all are familiar with Feed the Future. I suspect you are. The U.S. Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative really came out of the 2007-2008 food price crisis, President Obama's leadership at the L'Aquila Summit in 2009, which committed the U.S. to significantly increasing its investments in food security to $3.5 billion over a three-year period, and also leveraged in significant investment from other donors, a total of I think $22.5 billion, but also has been leveraging in over the past year much greater investment from the private sector as well. So that's in itself a game changer for all of us, that food security is back on the agenda. But related to Tag's work here, it's not your father or your grandfather's food security or your grandmother's food security. For the first time in my career, we hardly say agriculture without saying nutrition. And that really, 5 years ago, that didn't happen at all. And I think it's due to the work of folks like Tag, other people in the university community, that we now do think about agriculture in terms of this is not just about increasing agricultural productivity or even about increasing farm incomes. It's also about improving the efficiency through the value chain, but it's also very, very much about improving nutritional quality, improving the statistics on stunting, looking at malnutrition at the same time as we're looking at agriculture. So we look at agriculture improvements, but we also look at their impact on the nutrition of the family. It's really hard to underestimate, I think, or do justice in just 2 seconds to what that means for USAID and other partners. It means for us that we're asking all of our missions not just to look at investments in agriculture anymore. They're very much held to a standard of how are your investments, how do your priorities reflect a focus on nutrition. And we're seeing how this is really spilling over to the countries themselves. So, again, for the first time in many of our careers, ministries of agriculture are speaking with ministries of health. And we're seeing kind of a multiplier effect as other donors take this on as well. So, for example, after the Olympics, the UK, which holds the G8 presidency after we relinquished it this year, is also putting significant focus on nutrition. So I just wanted to lay that out. That's new, and it really builds on work like what TAG will be discussing with you today. The second point I wanted to draw your attention to is we're also seeing the ascendance of livestock in general, you know, as a Feed the Future and U.S. government priority. I think we can trace that back. We really haven't invested significantly in livestock for a quarter of a century, but the Horn of Africa events, the erratic climate events in the Sahel have really brought front and center the importance of livestock for as an animal-sourced food, source of animal protein, but also their role as savings accounts, their role in diversification of income, their role in providing some kind of buffer, you know, for people to absorb shocks a bit better. So I think we're very excited, particularly in the research section, to see enhanced focus on livestock. We're working with partners in the public and private sector, particularly on the development of animal vaccines. Okay, and then the last point I wanted to make, also related to TAG, is just I think this kind of research really brings to the fore the important role that U.S. universities play with USAID and development in general. This research shows sort of persistence over 30 years of research really to build an evidence foundation for the kind of, I would say, sweeping policy changes that we're seeing today with regard to nutrition, with regard to investment in livestock. So it's we value those kinds of partnerships in USAID, and again, U.S. universities and their contributions are being brought front and center to the development agenda. TAG will talk about not only the importance of research, but the importance of capacity building alongside research. That's been a hallmark of many of the investments that USAID has made over the years, particularly the collaborative research support programs. And many of you may know, sort of, we're launching now a new era in USAID, U.S. university relationships with the launch of the Higher Education Solutions Network by Secretary Clinton and Administrator Shaw last Friday. And this establishes 7 development laboratories at different U.S. universities and consortia to focus on everything from food security to better utilization of aid data to social entrepreneurship, all in a multidisciplinary setting. So with that, those 3 points, really, sort of thinking about nutrition and how it's really ascended and really brought that front and center. Secondly, livestock the same way. Thirdly, just to reflect as you listen to TAG about the influence of universities on development and sort of our thinking nowadays about how universities are brought into policy discussions, and I think will be much more directly interacting with us at USAID as we go forward with Feed the Future and implementing the G8 New Alliance. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming. Thank you, Julie, for that introduction. I would just say, in response to what Julie said, that we really welcomed Feed the Future as an initiative. It did something that we in the land-grant community have been trying, I would say, somewhat unsuccessfully to do, which is cross the barrier between agriculture and human nutrition. And one of the delights of being a director of something like a CRISP is that you can step across that boundary at a university because you have some resources to do that. Today, I want to talk to you about something that's near and dear to my heart. I've been doing international development for a long time. I won't tell you how long, but I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ethiopia and worked with USAID back in the Haile Selassie era of Ethiopia. So you can guess how long that, you can take your guess. And in that time period, on and off, I've gained sort of my personal perspective on development. And one of the things that I think is fundamental to any successful development, to the sustainability of anything you do, is human capital. And human capital is critical in developing countries. Nothing is sustained by outside efforts, in my experience. I've reviewed lots and lots of programs. I've had programs of my own. And unless you build the capacity in developing countries to carry on what you do or to have the expertise for what you do, then things are not sustained and they are not scaled up. So today I want to talk about human capital. And the most fundamental component of human capital really starts with children. They are the future of human capital in a country. I don't know how well you can see the eyes of this young man, but he's peering into the room with, I think, some apprehension, some expectation. And he's looking into the future, and his future is, this is a Ghanaian, his future is Ghana's future. And if we can increase the capacity of this child multiplied across a population, then you can have a huge impact on the things that we're most interested in, which are economic and social development. I want to give you what I would call a conceptual model. This is something that comes out of our actually consultation that APLU organized with USAID for Feed the Future. And it's also something that I somewhat borrowed from a professor at Emory, Mortarel, who's done longitudinal studies, some of the best longitudinal studies ever, about 30-plus years in Guatemala on the impact of nutritional interventions early in life on everything up to what happens to you when you're 30 or 40 years old. And this is it's not the kind of monitoring evaluation USAID can do, but it is the kind of monitoring and evaluation that actually is necessary to understand the true impact of nutrition early in life. But I call this the virtual cycle because it's a positive feedback cycle. What happens is you increase food supply and diet quality, one of the objectives of Feed the Future. You reduce poverty and malnutrition. You improve child and maternal nutrition so children are more cognitively active. You improve an education system, which improves your workforce, would give you more and greater knowledge and technology development, entrepreneurial activity, which increases economic growth, and that feeds around this cycle in various repetitions. So this is, I think, a useful conceptual view of the system that we approached. We focused our efforts right here. Now, what I want to do is I want to talk about a USAID success story. And I know that USAID is very interested in success stories, and so are we. We want to be successful. We want to see the results of what we do be more than just the generation of information, but we want it to actually impact people. Well, there were 30 years of commitment on this through USAID in various forms. There was the Nutrition Crisp research in the 1980s, and I'll talk about that in general. These are quite a large consortium. It did work in Mexico, Egypt, and Kenya. That was followed by the Global Livestock Crisp, which had two projects, the Child Nutrition Project, which was in Kenya, Embu, and in Ghana, in three places in Ghana, Enam Project, and I'll talk about that. So we went from 1980s to the 1990s to the 2000s. Some background, probably you all know this. more than 1 billion people suffer from malnutrition. Much of it is micronutrient malnutrition. Much of it, many of these, are children. What are the impacts? Well, micronutrient malnutrition affects the immune system. It affects cognitive and physical development. It affects workforce productivity, lifespan, and quality of life, all the things that make an individual productive in a society. Fogel, who got the Nobel Prize for some of this work, a professor at Chicago, estimates that half of the economic growth during the Industrial Revolution in England was due to nutritional impacts. So that gives you a sense of the relationship between nutrition and actual economic growth. So the human nutrition crisp, this is the one in the 1980s. This was the first one. In 1977, the National Research Council conducted a world food study. And out of that came the question, does malnutrition, moderate malnutrition, have an impact on human function? And the general consensus was that energy was thought to be the main causal factor. Now, if you had taken that information at that point in time and used it as in your project design, you might have found that you weren't successful, in part because we now know that energy was not the major limiting causal factor. But in response, USAID developed the Human Nutrition CRISP, and it was an observational non-intervention study in Mexico, Kenya, and Egypt. It lasted for 5 years. It was a survey study. They measured the changes in children. They observed what they ate, and they made general broad conclusions. It was a mega survey. The most important findings of that CRISP were that quality was much more important than quantity, that animal-source foods were the best predictor of cognitive function. That is, the amount of animal-source foods in the diet, even when it was controlled for socioeconomic status and other variables. But sadly, it was ignored. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. When I became director of the what was then the small ruminant CRISP, later the global livestock CRISP, I was surprised that this finding was not well known. It was kind of buried in the literature. And I thought it, especially from a livestock point of view, this was fairly significant. So what happened? Well, I need to digress a little bit. When the small ruminant CRISP, which I inherited as a director, came to an end, we worked with John Lewis, who was very supportive, in redesigning the CRISP. And we redesigned it in ways that were sensitive to USAID's needs. But we did have some latitude. We were able to run three major workshops, one in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, one in Entebbe, and one in San Jose, Costa Rica, where we brought stakeholders together for 4 days to set priorities. The one in Tashkent was really interesting. This was in 1996. I stood up and asked people as the director, to set the priorities, and there was a great silence. And they looked at me and they said, well, you're the guy with the money. You set the priorities, and we'll do what you say. Well, it took us a little while to actually convince them that by the end of day four, they were arm wrestling over priorities, which was really quite an interesting experience. So in each case, we spent a considerable amount of time trying to define the issues. And out of the sub-Saharan workshop, one of the issues that came up was child malnutrition. So in each one of these was we set a series of problem models. And those problem models, that was a question about what needed to be done, what were the primary issues. Those were turned into RFAs for the competition for the CRISP projects. And one was one. The one for child nutrition was won by UCLA, University of Nairobi, Hawaii, and UC Davis. And it was then to do an intervention study that would either confirm or reject the hypothesis that animal source foods were important in cognitive and physical development. Well, it was quite an effort. 1,000 kids over a five-year period. Each child got a container with his name on it with the treatment food. There were four different treatments. There was a control, that is, we measured students who were not given a supplement at lunch on a school day. We had milk plus guthiri, which is a local stew, meat and guthiri, and milk and guthiri, and those were isocaloric, so they were balanced calorically. The students got these every school day. Each one was measured if they didn't eat them all. We measured just about everything about child behavior, physiological response, growth, school performance, and intelligence tests. We employed, I think, about 100 people in the process of cooking these meals for over a three-year period, and then they were all put on motorcycles and driven out to the 12 different schools that were involved. Raven's scores, this is a culturally neutral intelligence test. The meat group did about 15 to 20% better on Raven's scores, that is on IQ score. In terms of test scores, they did a grade and a half higher in school, the meat group. This is a meat group, by the way. Compared to all other groups in behavior, we measured their behavior on playgrounds. They had the greatest increase in percent time in high activity, and least in low activity. They spent more time in leadership and initiative behaviors. That is, they initiated behaviors. They were intended to be more leadership. And the teachers complained they were more talkative, playful, and disruptive. So there was a very definite impact on the behavior. In fact, I spent a fair amount of time because my then high school daughter worked on this project as a volunteer one summer. And I could walk into a classroom and I could tell you exactly if it was a meat classroom or if it was a control classroom. There was a total difference in behavior. We published this we published the results of this and other work in a special supplement of the Journal of Nutrition. And we had a conference here in Washington, D.C. that presented the results. And we wanted to know what was the next step. And what was the next step? Well, people said, meat's good for children. But how are you going to get meat into the diets of children? That was the challenge. So we put out another RFA, and we have always in our in this CRISP, we've always used planning grants. We gave a small amount of money and a little bit of time. And then we had, I think there was, Susan, what were the four planning grants that were accepted? And then after the planning grant, they wrote a full proposal, and we selected a team from Iowa State, led by Grace Marquis. She went to McGill, so she became, it was McGill, Iowa State. And then a wonderful group at the University of Ghana, led by Larte and Colcraft. They have quite good capacity in Ghana in nutrition. Now, what was this? Enom actually means meat in the local language, but it was how do you then get meat into the diets of children? Enom then spent a year doing a survey across Ghana, more than a survey, workshops where they sat down with the local NGOs, with the communities, and analyzed what they thought the constraints were on the consumption of animal-source foods. And I will show you a little bit more of the problem model, but in general, it was certainly the knowledge of nutritional impacts of the food groups. People did not understand that meat was actually good for children. In some cases, people thought it was a negative impact on children. And income of households. And we then created an intervention experiment. How did we do this? Well, we formed women's groups, and those women's groups were led by a trained facilitator that we selected, the project selected, very dynamic and charismatic young ladies who were then trained in all of the aspects that were required of the program, and then they went in and helped organize and lead and sustain the women's groups. And they provided nutritional education. Income-generating activities were done in conjunction with Heifer, and microfinance was done through the CRISP. And so here is the problem model, and we use problem models as, in a sense, a rich hypothesis. What we did was we, in developing our projects, we tried to identify in the planning phase what was the issue we were going to attack. That we knew: animal source of foods, availability and accessibility, and utilization. And then what were the constraints to this, which are the circles, and what were the ways we were going to intervene that we thought would possibly change the system. So the idea is to develop a kind of a conceptual model that allows you to allocate your resources and to make sure who is the appropriate members of your team. So in this case, poor nutritional knowledge, unequal high household allocation, cultural beliefs and practices were all tackled by a nutritional education through the women's groups. Financial support for caregiver income, was provided by the microfinance, and the training for animal source food income generating activities and entrepreneurial skills was done through both through the women's groups and with the assistance of an NGO, including capacity building for the extension. This was done sort of outside of the work I will show you today. What was done then was a controlled experiment. In that experiment, there were 600 baseline mother-caregiver pairs that were actually measured. They were then divided into three groups: the ones that would receive in a community the intervention, the people in the community, in that same community, who did not receive the intervention, and then people in communities outside of the project, which were non-implementing communities. And data was then collected on nutritional knowledge, diet diversity of the children, nutritional state of the children, women's income, household food security. So it was, in a sense, an experiment to see how well our intervention actually would work. Well, what were the outcomes? Well, household food security decreased, incomes increased of women, increased consumption of animal source foods by children, increase in protein, calcium, iron, zinc in the diet of children, improved child nutrition status, i.e. weight for age, and interestingly enough, the banks got very interested in this because the women were saving lots and lots of money. So it had a very positive effect. Post-ENOM sustainability, over $2 million have been loaned in this program now, and 2,200 women are involved. That's from a start of six women's groups. The majority of the income of the was increased enough in the original groups that they're sending their children to private schools. One trainer who's particularly good has established 80 new groups in and around Accra. And the education and microfinance model for ENOM is now the business model for a number of the rural banks. And in one case I know of, the rural bank main business now are these women's groups. And the recent Nutrition CRISP that was formed has a design which I'm pleased to say is consistent with the ENOM model. If you want to look at the specifics of this, there's a supplement to the an ENOM supplement in the African Journal of Food, Agriculture, Nutrition, and Development that will give you the details of all these results. So let me conclude by saying to you that, to me, children are the future, and their knowledge and creativity and leadership are the future of developing countries. And so if we want sustainable development, development driven by country ownership, then we must feed the future. Thank you. Just a second. Let me just thank some people, too. First of all, John Lewis, Felipe Mantega, John Hopgood, John Thomas, and Josette Lewis were really supportive of us and gave us the freedom to be able to do things in a, I think, an interesting way. I have to thank Joyce Turk, who's been in this for 20-plus years in the small room and in CRISP, and she's outlasted us all. And Joyce was totally supportive, but gave us enough freedom to be creative within the space that USAID allowed, and I just want to thank her and applaud her for her work. I'd also like to thank Title 12, which really establishes a very nice framework for the relationship between U.S. universities and USAID. And Title 12 is being revived a bit by BIFAD, which is being revived in its sense by Brady Deaton. And then the principal investigators, Charlotte Newman, Nimrod Buibo, Lindsay Allen, Suzanne Murphy, Grace Marquis, Alan Larty, S.E. Colcraft, all running one of these projects is really quite a challenge. You're dealing with bureaucracy. They had to deal with my bureaucracy at UC Davis. They had to deal with federal bureaucracy. They had to deal with in-country bureaucracy. And then they had to get the job done. And it takes quite a bit of leadership and sacrifice. I'd also like to thank the thousands of participants who have been in all of these studies. We poked and prodded them probably more than they wanted. But they were incredibly tolerant of our invasiveness. And then the rural banks of Ghana really have taken this, and I'm very pleased that they stepped in. It gives us a sustainability that I think is remarkable. And then one other person, Susan Johnson. Susan Johnson has worked with me for a long time. And Susan has been terrific. She has been a real force in the creativity of this program, and as associate director at Davis, and now runs the Borlaug Leap program at Davis, another wonderful relationship we have with USAID. So thank you very much.